You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. If you have a morning or an early afternoon commute, I don't need to tell you that school is back. As you know, we're located at Sac State. Every time I drive in, especially today, the parking lots are just packed. The campus energy is very much alive. A few months ago, we here at Insight, we launched a segment called Chalk Talk with our very own Sacramento education reporter, Srishti Prabha. Srishti focuses on K-12 education, which is just a huge beat considering there are more than a dozen school districts in Sacramento County alone. So it became difficult to pick and choose which topics to talk about on Insight because they're all important. So with a little bit of brainstorming, we came up with Chalk Talk as a monthly segment to get up to speed on Trishy's latest reporting. And with just weeks into the new year, they have been busy on the education beat, covering everything from the mental health of students following natural disasters, number crunching the latest state budget proposal and how public education fits into it, and breaking down a very important but also a cryptic funding formula that is being challenged as not benefiting the students that it's meant to serve. So Srishti joins us now with a breakdown of their latest reporting. Hey, Srishti.
Hi, Vicky. You made me sound way more busy than maybe I actually was, but it sounds good.
Yeah, well, we are very proud of you. And I'm actually really excited because you've been doing Chalk Talk for a couple months now with interim host Alan Young while I was on leave. So this is my first time doing Chalk Talk, which is awesome. But it has been a minute. It's a new year. This is the first Chalk Talk of 2025. Woo-hoo. What have you been up to?
Oh, man. I mean, even though I'm just an education reporter, I do like to reap the benefits of being on the school's holiday cycle. So I took a vacation during winter break because we all deserve it.
Absolutely.
And I took that time to read, crochet, and take pictures with my new Polaroid camera. It's being a little difficult with me, but I'm going to figure it out. did you get some rest this holiday season?
I did. I mean, your break sounded really restorative, and I think that's a great reset before you start a new year. For myself, I took the last week of the year off, as I've been public about. I just was celebrating being done with breast cancer treatment, not having doctor's appointments.
Yay.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And now I'm just happy to get back into Insight full time. This is the third week of hosting full time here at Cap Radio. And really, I don't got to tell you this. I mean, this year really hit the ground running with news. It was not a simmer to a boil by any means.
No, we definitely, it was a jolt back to reality for me. But I am glad to get to do this segment with you. I think that's, you know, obviously a positive. But the jolt back was really with the wildfires in LA. Of course, now we're dealing with a lot of different things. Even though they're not directly impacting us in Northern California, we have been intimately familiar with fires in Northern California, right?
Oh, absolutely. As a field reporter myself, I've covered many over the years. The ones in Los Angeles really hit close to home because I am an Angeleno. My parents were right on the border of the evacuation orders of the Eaton Fire. Luckily, they're okay, but unfortunately, I do have loved ones and friends who lost their homes. And unfortunately, even if you don't live in Southern California, you could live here in Northern California, there are just millions of people who can relate where that resonates to across the state. They've lived through this before. Mm-hmm. So whether you're directly impacted by a wildfire, millions of other people are impacted and shaped by breathing in just the smoke, the hazardous air that can travel hundreds of miles.
Yeah, the AQI up here in Sacramento this past weekend was pretty bad because of the fires. And I saw my own mom's asthma get triggered in 2020 after the fires in the South Bay Area where I'm from. And this was the PG&E situation where things were catching fire everywhere. And it was pretty upsetting. And it's a new reality for my parents and for me and definitely for the younger generation. I don't really remember having these concerns when I was in high school a decade ago. Do you?
Oh, no. I'm older than you. I won't say how much older, but I'm definitely older than you.
Maybe I feel too comfortable sharing my age.
And when coming from a metro area like Los Angeles, I mean, we didn't really think about wildfires when I was in school. Now, it is understandably a crucial topic of discussion in schools and something that you have a lot of experience reporting on.
Yeah, I was reporting on wildfire smoke and storms in Sacramento over the past few years. We had in California 1,600 schools closed due to wildfires between 2019 and 2020. And in Sacramento, you had recent atmospheric rivers, which was a term we had to learn in 2023, which impacted 107 schools in one day. So in this scenario, we're seeing more than 1,000 have closed in LA due to wildfires, which is significantly more than what we've seen in the past. So you're seeing the intensity and the frequency of these wildfires increase. Luckily, LAUSD has resumed session now. But there are some things that came to the forefront when we were having these conversations, things like providing meals for families that rely on it during fires, because the school meal might be the only meal for some of these students. Proper school infrastructure. What do working air filters look like? Do we have fire-resistant building materials? Do we have greener spaces to absorb heat on hotter days? And then obviously mental health challenges and possible learning loss.
Yeah, schools have really been through it in the last 5 years. I mean, not just wildfires you mentioned, flooding, winter storms, of course, the pandemic and learning loss. Given that I'm a product of LAUSD, I'm an Angeleno, it's a huge school district. The student population is more than the city of Sacramento, 600,000 students. And that's just one school district that was impacted by wildfires across Los Angeles.
Yeah, LAUSD must be grappling with a lot of different issues at this point, including the displaced students, which was a reportedly 700,000 students. I know that you had an insight segment where you discussed this. Do you want to give a little recap?
Right. Yeah, we had Abel Guillen. He was a deputy superintendent with the California Department of Education, telling us that around 10 public schools had been destroyed. Hundreds of thousands of students had been displaced, just as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we've been here too many times before. I remember when I covered the campfire in Butte County, I went up to that area, which includes communities of Paradise, Magalia, Concow, Polga, consistently for more than a year, watching rebuilding. A lot of these sites moved to nearby Chico. It is no easy feat to rebuild a school.
Yeah, Paradise had to completely rebuild from scratch. When I spoke to Tom Taylor, who was the superintendent of Butte County at the time when the campfire happened, he mentioned that, you know, things have still not really gotten back to normal. Unfortunately, those students also were hit with COVID, so that's just like a double impact kind of situation. But yeah, he's saying that it's still something that they're grappling with. And he himself has a few regrets.
You really got to work on the staff's mental health. We spent 4 full days with the top mental health specialists in the country, helping the Paradise teachers prepare for the kids coming back, and it still wasn't enough time.
He says that the educators had gone through so much that they couldn't properly support the students immediately, and even 3 weeks was just not enough time to start school again. It just didn't make sense.
Yeah, it's a profoundly traumatic situation. It takes a lot of time to heal from that. And that healing is still very much happening today. You also mentioned a double punch of having pandemic shutdowns after the campfire. So we've had a lot of conversations about mental health and students, as well as teachers and staff well-being. What did you learn?
So yeah, I spoke with mental health experts and researchers on what does this mean currently? You know, how do we deal with this crisis immediately? But then also, what are the prolonged effects of what might happen and what we've seen maybe in Paradise and other areas like the Sonoma fires? I spoke with Dr. Adrian Hines, who's a clinical psychologist at Stanford, and her research stems from the wildfires in Sonoma County, where she developed an app for young people impacted by the climate disasters.
Tools like coping with stress, kind of your basic guardrails, right? Managing anger. There's a lot of need to understand and create a narrative for who to blame. And the irritability that also comes with having to endure challenge after challenge and just continue to problem solve. Self-care, just prioritizing yourself, healing from loss, so educating about grief. Teen experiences, like your parents don't get you, your grades are slipping. You might be engaging in more risky behaviors because what's the point? The world's burning anyway. The kids said they found that validating and they felt seen and in a way that is kind of unique to disaster.
Yeah. Navigating grief is just so complex, especially I think when you are not even an adult yet. You know, you're still just trying to figure out life and who you are. So that app seems like one great tool for teens and young adults. Is that the only?
Unfortunately, the app actually doesn't exist anymore. And it's because she mentioned the funding ran out. And to keep an app going, you need more money. And it gets outdated over time because the operating systems change. So I think she was advocating for this type of app to actually exist on a broader scale for students that, you know, in California especially, who are going to be dealing with things like this more frequently than
not. Well, that's a bummer. So did you find any other solutions that are taking place?
I did find another solution. It's not all that. So I also spoke to Dr. Alyssa Epple, who's a professor at UC San Francisco and heads the UC-wide Council on Climate Health. She has developed a very innovative college class to teach climate resilience. And she feels like it should be part of the education system starting at a very young age.
In our climate resilience class, we brought together inspirational leaders, science, and contemplative practices, emotional resilience skills that they could practice together in the classroom. So it was a different kind of class. It was not just academic. It was experiential. And what we found was that the students had improvements in their climate distress, but also in their general mental health, less anxiety, less depression, more climate hope, more self-efficacy that they could work together to make change.
And I can see why she would argue that this needs to be available for younger students, because I've learned from you multiple times when you've joined us, Rushdie, that climate and climate anxiety, it is a big issue for young people.
Especially if they're directly now seeing the impacts, right? So you need to have these conversations, especially if you can do preventative work, if you can start in elementary school and prep them. You know, this is how, if something like this happens to you, this is how you can be an agent for change. Because one of the things that she had mentioned was that also these people become leaders in the community because now they know how to deal with the trauma and how to actually affect change. So whether that's policy, whether that's rebuilding in the community, whether that's, I don't know, planting trees, I don't know. You know, you can do so many different things to feel empowered and not just feel like there is no hope.
Yeah, they're finding agency because they have that lived experience. I want to go back to when we had the Department of Education on about a week or so ago talking about the wildfires in Los Angeles and really focusing on solutions. I remember having conversations on Insight about HVACs in classrooms and it being a challenge, this really crucial filtration from particulate matter, and that a lot of the buildings at public schools, they're dated. And so you joined us about Prop 2. We talked about it briefly in the prior segment. It was approved by voters. It's supposed to help with this. But what's up with all of that now?
Right. I think you did just talk about it. It authorizes modernization projects, updating school systems, building new facilities. The thing is, that's $100 billion worth of things that need to happen in the state, but only $10 billion of funding that's actually been received. So
that's a tenth.
Yeah, a tenth. And now you have these fires. So that means, what does that mean for resource allocation? Like, how much of that funding? I'm sure the person before me mentioned that this is going to be an issue. How much of this money is going to go to rebuilding schools, and how much of it is actually going to be used for what it was initially intended for? And I think HVAC systems are super, super important because they're the thing that helps you, during wildfire season. Kids can still go and be safe at a school site and still continue to learn. And a recent report from the state auditor's office found that not a single school surveyed was meeting all the state standards for maintained facilities. That's obviously another story for another day, but that also indicates that a lot of HVAC systems probably require maintenance, and schools are having to make the hard choice between funding academic programs or repairing facilities like HVAC systems, which are super necessary.
Yeah, budgets are so thin. There's not a lot of wiggle room, and you have to make a lot of tough decisions because both are crucial to education. When you kind of dove into HVACs and wildfire smoke and how it impacts children, what did you learn about the consequences of not having HVACs that are up to standard?
Well, even if they are up to standard, I learned that you know, it's possible that young children are more vulnerable to wildfire smoke. And I learned that from a PPIC, or the Public Policy Institute of California's research associate, Shalini Mustala, who talked to me about this.
Wildfire smoke has particulate matter that's easily penetrable into respiratory system that children are affected because they tend to spend more time outside and they have higher breathing rates. Their inhalation of these particulate matter is higher.
So not only are they breathing in the particulate matter more, so that's obviously going to have an impact on their general health, this type of wildfire smoke exposure has also been linked to reduced school performance and cognitive function.
That makes a lot of sense. When I would cover wildfires that have burned homes, I would get headaches. Mm-hmm. You definitely develop physical symptoms from drinking smoke, from breathing it in. Yeah. It can feel like drinking it in when it's really thick for extended periods of time.
Yeah, and think about when you don't have enough oxygen. Generally in the air, you feel lightheaded, you feel like you can't focus. So I'm sure not having proper oxygen is part of not being able to learn.
Yeah, it's crucial to learning. At the root of all of this, Rishti, is money. And that money comes from the state. We do have an idea of Governor Newsom's budget priorities. He laid out his state budget proposal. It's going to look different between now and the May revise and when mm-hmm. it's finalized in June. But as it stands now, where does education fit into this?
It's all about money, like you said. And, you know, now that we're going through it, I'm like, I really am covering a lot of topics out here. But what we have found is that $119 billion are maybe going to be dedicated to schools, public schools, because we don't know yet. And that's Prop 98 funding. Prop 98 is the proposition that dedicates 40% of the general fund in the state to education. Also that there will be a 2.4% cost of living adjustment to the education funding formula, which we're going to talk a little bit about later. So it'll make more sense. This is $3 billion more than last year. They're also going to put a $1.5 billion deposit into the rainy day fund, which was actually drained due to the deficit last year, which is a 2-year debt they're going to use from the rainy day fund. So that's another element. And then there's possibly an 8% cut to UC and CSU systems. So it's a lot going on.
Yeah. So there's boosts in some areas, cuts in other areas. And this is all preliminary because the state budget gets finalized mm-hmm. in June. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Sacramento education reporter Srishti Prabha in our monthly segment, Chalk Talk, getting up to speed with Srishti's latest education reporting. Okay, you foreshadowed this. You touched upon it. We dipped our toes into money, the state budget. So I'm going to wait a little bit further.
Okay? Are you ready?
Yes. Into the funding structures surrounding public education. So it gets a little wonky, it can feel complicated, but it is just so important when it comes to families. So let's do LCFF 101.
Okay.
That is for the local control funding formula. What is it?
So you're going to hear LCFF, right? People say it all the time in education. And if you're a parent, you might not even know what that is. I wouldn't. Unless I was working in education, I would have never understood what LCFF is. So local control funding formula. It was instituted a decade ago in 2013. And what it does is it has this formula with three buckets. So you have a per pupil amount that you will receive. So if you have 100 students in your, you know, school or district, whatever, number of students in your district, you're going to get money for that. Then the three buckets will kind of determine how much extra funding you get. So you have the English language learners bucket, the foster and unhoused students bucket, and those receiving free and reduced lunch, which is usually the marker for low-income students. It also has a concentration grant, and you have the equity multiplier. There's like other things that have been added on to kind of provide extra support to districts with higher need students. But we're starting to see that this formula might not be working the way that it's intended. One of the metrics, which is offering free lunch, that changed because California now offers universal free lunch. So you might not be able to tell what students are even getting free lunch. And it's not always a marker for which student is maybe in a low-income neighborhood or has parents maybe working 3-4 jobs. So that metric isn't working. And the PPIC, again, I'll say it, it's the Public Policy Institute of California, a lot of acronyms. Julian LaFortune is one of the research fellows, and this is what he had to say about it.
What we would want is that the metrics that we're identifying funding are actually correlated with these gaps in outcomes. And that's not really what we see for free and reduced price meals, which is our main indicator for low income.
And as you mentioned, LCFF, which can go over someone's head, is really meant to help school districts and campuses that have high need students. And that can be from, as you mentioned, from a range from English language learners to foster unhoused students, low income students as well. I think of like Sac City Unified, which has more than 75% of students are on free and reduced lunch. Over 24 languages are spoken within the district. So this ultimately trickles down to families. Are they actually feeling this disconnect?
Yeah, so it's actually not working. The PPIC report also mentions that, like, when you look at actual educational outcomes, these markers are not the identifiers for whether or not students are getting the support services they require. Because the whole point of this funding model is to get money into the hands of schools where students need the most resources. And actually, that's not what we're seeing. And so something has to change. I actually wanted to know if parents are witnessing these disparities, and I reached out to a community-based organization that works with Spanish-speaking families to empower them to advocate for the disparities they see around them. A little known fact is that the LCFF is accompanied by something called the LCAP, which is the Local Control Accountability Plan, where parents can actually sit on a board and make sure that the model of LCFF, the educational funding model, is actually delivering resources in the appropriate ways at school sites. So they actually can help parents understand, hey, you can join your LCAP committee and like check and see where your funds are going. But why would people know what LCAP is, what LCFF is, especially if you're not a first language English speaker? I'm already lost in the sauce, and that is one of my languages. And I can't imagine if you're not even a speaker of that language to be like, what do I do for my students, you know? So the Latino Education Advancement Foundation is a nonprofit based in San Jose that helps specifically get parents involved and empowered to talk about these issues. They kind of have a cute name. It's LEAF. Isn't that
I like
nice?
It. Yeah. That's the best acronym so far.
Yeah. I know, LCFF, LCAP, LEAF. They're unique in their approach, and it's important to talk about this in San Jose because the Pain Index in Silicon Valley shows that there is high income disparities across race. So I actually did speak to a parent. Her name is Irma Castillo. She's living in East San Jose. She has worked in the school system for 14 years as an aide and witnessed fund disparity in East San Jose compared to neighboring districts. And she lives in an area with a majority multi-language learner student population and those with special needs. You're going to hear her right now speaking in Spanish, and then I'll translate.
Vemos que existe la necesidad de que se haga un ajuste, ¿verdad? O que haya alguien que diga o que abogue por pelear por esos derechos económicos para que haya una mejor educación en los distritos escolares que tengan de mayor necesidad, pues, en sí.
So in English, what she said is, what we see is that there exists the necessity for an adjustment to be made, or that someone that can say or advocates fighting for those economic rights says that there's better education for school districts that have a higher need. They need people to advocate for them, and they need help having a say. I want to mention that I got help translating from my co-reporter, Manola Sakaira, and if there's anything to be said, hearing her in language is probably more important because that is where she feels most well-versed and feels comfortable talking about something so important like economic disparity. You might not, you know, she might not be able to convey that as well in English when she goes to a school site. So I think that's why we left it in Spanish to actually hear what she had to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I get it. Mm-hmm. So what is, I mean, and just hearing about the need for advocacy, I think that's where organizations like LEAF come in.
The importance of organizations like LEAF is that they actually are giving parents agency to help their children have different educational outcomes. And Irma talked to me in Spanish also, probably for my benefit, and was quite emotional about the access to education her children deserve.
I'm going to do this for my daughter. My daughter is 16, and I want her to go to the university. I need to learn more. But at the beginning, I was so frustrated because I didn't know a lot of things. And I think a lot of parents are in that situation like I was. For me, this is really important.
Yeah, I mean, that's just palpable. You can just hear how important this is for not only for herself, for her children. And she is just one parent, one adult with a vested interest in this. So I guess, Trishy, as we close this, what do people want?
They want better metrics that account for intersectionality. So one thing that I didn't explain and I want to explain now is that there's this thing called the unduplicated count. So if you fall in one bucket, like let's say you're a foster youth, but you also are an English language learner, they will not give you funds because you're in both buckets. You'll only get funds for being in one of the buckets. And that completely ignores that we live this life that's very intersectional, that you might be filling many buckets and require more resources than the average person. And so I think researchers and advocates alike feel like the unduplicated count does not make sense. I spoke to Education Trust West, which is a nonprofit think tank that works for educational equity, and they talked about something called the Social Disparity Index, which thinks about high prevalence of asthma in a neighborhood or high prevalence of gun violence in a neighborhood, or if there's access to wealth building opportunities or home ownership opportunities. Those might be better indicators than just the free and reduced lunch bucket, which is the main identifier for if you're low income.
Well, I'm happy that there are parents like Irma. Trishy, thank you so much for sharing a lot of reporting that you've already done with just, 3 weeks into the new year.
I know. Welcome to Chalk Talk. So happy to start this with you now.
Chalk Talk 2025.
Yeah.
That is Sacramento education reporter Trishy Prabha in our monthly insight segment, Chalk Talk, getting up to speed with Trishy's latest education reporting. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.